Now, you know, it relates to your question, what led us to, you know, adopt this resilience approach? I think some of us who, like me, were involved in the big famine back in the mid-80s, you know, with Bob Geldof and We Are the World back in the Horn of Africa, and got involved in that. And then looking at the aftermath said, you know, we really need to find a way to bring together relief and humanitarian assistance with development projects in a more structured way. Some of you might remember in the mid-90s, we had the Greater Horn of Africa initiative. I was a part of that. It was the first initial foray, if you will, into that. But I don't know if the time wasn't right or we weren't ready or it didn't really get anywhere. Then in 2011, there was another major drought in the Horn of Africa. I happened to be the USA director in Ethiopia at the time. And in many ways, it was as big as the one back in the 80s, okay? And the results in Somalia were very bad. You did have a famine with thousands and thousands of people dying of starvation. But we didn't in Ethiopia and Kenya. And so that was kind of the wake-up for us. Okay, what's happening here? How do we do a better job of bringing together humanitarian assistance and development? And maybe we have learned some lessons. What did we do right in Ethiopia and Kenya that we didn't there? And then, of course, conflict was a huge part of that, obviously, in Somalia. And that was, in a way, the critical factor that kept us from being able to save people there. But in Ethiopia and Kenya, a big part of it started from a much better job of, first of all, predicting when things were going to happen by putting in the FuseNet system where we could track rainfall patterns and growth of cereals, movement of people, and so on. Then also, obviously, we had networks on the ground and programs going on, and we had put in some flexibility into some of our programs already. So, for instance, in Ethiopia, we had something called the Crisis Modifier, which allowed us to put OFDA, if you will, or humanitarian assistance funding into a development program that was already in place. So rather than bringing in a new partner to deal with the crisis, you could work with your existing partner and give them more funding and more flexibility to deal with the issue. And so that got us thinking, and so from that we started a more resilience-focused approach. We launched the following year a policy and program guidance. Then within USAID, we've done a lot of sort of institutionalizing, trying to figure out, okay, how do we do a better job of bringing together the humanitarian assistance side and the development side? And also, even in our sort of planning and programming approaches. So we have set up a resilience leadership team of senior people across the agency that meet on a regular basis. We set up a secretariat, which is now going to become the Resilience Center, to kind of provide some ongoing lessons learned and a way of sharing information and providing support to the missions. We set up a joint coordination council or team within the Sahel and in the Horn. We call it the JCC to bring together different countries who are working on these things. And then, of course, with Rockefeller, we've set up the Global Resilience Partnership, which provides a partnership with some organizations that we don't always work with, and some innovation, realizing that we don't have all the answers. And the way we've always done things hasn't necessarily been the best way, and we can get some new ideas. So that's sort of the institutional side, but what does it actually mean on the ground? So let me throw out a couple examples, and then, you know, we can talk more as we go on today. So for instance, in Ethiopia, if you look into southern Ethiopia, those of you who know the area, it's pastoralist area, semi-desert, and you've got small, you know, and large groups of pastoralists. But they're very vulnerable to a variety of problems, which means fragility, okay? They're vulnerable to climate shocks, to climate change. They're vulnerable to conflict over resources, but even things like conflict over water sources. And then that gets exacerbated when there is a drought, okay? So people start moving, they bring their cattle, that causes conflict with the next group, you're fighting over water sources and so on. So you need an approach that looks at everything from climate change, natural resource management, conflict issues, the sort of social dynamics of the country, as well as your long-term development approach to that group of people and the resources they have. And that put together to me is building resilience, okay? So one of the things we found was that a lot of the wells in their areas were not well maintained. And many of them were in bad shape. Some of them were not even producing water or very small amounts of water. Okay. Then when there is a drought approaching, they're of course the first wells to fail. And that causes people to start moving to look for water somewhere else. That means they get into conflict with the next group over that water because they say, no, that's our water source. So what we normally had to do then is use humanitarian assistance money to truck water for the people from the area where the well was no longer working. Well, that was hugely expensive, as you can imagine, and trying to get, and even getting to some of these places. Whereas we found if we actually just repaired the wells before the drought began, they didn't fail. And you do it much cheaper, you reduce conflict, as well as also dealing with the issue of natural resource management and the aspects there. But also, from a more longer-term development process, as we're building the capacity of the pastoralists to raise cattle in a more sustainable way and provide a better return on their investment. What happens when you have a drought? Obviously, the cattle get hungry, they lack water, and they start to fail. So they start moving their cattle around. And the normal pastoralist, he's going to hold on to as many cattle as he can to keep them from dying. But let's say you've got a herd of 100, it's going to be a problem to keep all 100 going. What normally tends to happen is they keep trying to find water, they move, they find, and eventually they start dying off. But we found if you think of it in a more developmental approach, again from a more kind of a resilience approach, if they would sell off 50%, 25, 40, 50% of their cattle early on when they know there's a drought coming. So it goes back to you got to be able to forecast. So you sell off some of your cattle while they're still in good condition. Okay, you get a higher rate of return on that cattle. And the other 50 that you have left now, you can actually maintain them because you have a much smaller number. So even though you're selling off more cattle to begin with, you actually end up with more cattle and a better herd at the end than trying to keep all 100 and all of them go down. And then when you really need to, when they're down and, you know, almost about ready to die, you can't sell them because they're not worth anything anymore. So again, it's a longer term development approach, but it has to be factored into this part of the planning process and so on. So that's just an example where, you know, you have to have this multidisciplinary approach that you talked about, looking at natural resource management, conflict, the social aspects, as well as long-term development.